Is that you? Are you a gold digger? We get to a point in James where he addresses the thing that if you probably woke up this morning and knew what we were talking about, you'd been like, I think I'll skip this week because they're going to talk about wealth and money, and that's what we're going to address. Before I get there real quick, just kind of a shout out about one of the most important things we do at Genesis, and that is our community groups. And we just really believe that your growth as a follower of Jesus is going to happen best if you are in a group of people that are different than you, but that can challenge you and that you can pray with and do life and mission and open the scriptures with and all those sorts of things. That being part of a community is just vital to your growth. And we also get that it's hard. I'm not going to stand up here and go, hey, if you go to a community group, here's what's going to happen. Every week you're going to have cake and be around a group of people that are wonderful. Because sometimes it's very difficult to plow in and to really do the things that the gospel calls us to do. But I can tell you that it will be for your good and for the glory of God. And so we have community groups here. These are our, like the small version of our church that meets in homes. They do life and mission and ministry together. They serve one another. They eat meals together. They open the Bible. Most of the study they do looks at our sermons and just says, all right, how do we live this out tomorrow morning and figures that out together. And so this is the season where we kind of relaunch all our community groups. And almost all of them will have a special kind of get-together, a gathering in the next couple weeks. And so here's what I want to encourage you to do. If you're here today and you're part of a community group and you're happy, woohoo, stay in it. And if you're part of a community group and you're not happy, pray and say, should I stay with who I'm with or should I consider another group? But if you're already part of a group, now's the time to either re-engage that group or consider something else. And we give you permission, especially at this time, to say, I'm going to try something new. And if you're here with us and you're either new to Genesis or you've been coming for a while and you're not engaged in community, we want to encourage you that this is a great time to do it. So we have a table out in the foyer with all kinds of information about all of our groups. You can touch base there, and we can even tell you when these kickoffs are going to be and when groups are going to launch. And the, you know, most of them are going to have a special night where they're going to have like extra food and, you know, goodies because they want to entice you to come hang out with their group. And so just an encouragement to be considering that, to be thinking about that, and to find a way to get involved in community. Like I said, we just believe that it's important. So back in the 1800s, there was a famous Hispanic bank robber named Pepe Rodriguez, right? And Pepe Rodriguez had crossed the border from Mexico into Texas and had robbed a myriad of banks and then had snuck back over the border and was hiding in a small Mexican town. And the Texas Rangers went searching for him and found out where he was and crossed the border and cornered him in this saloon. And they finally got him to come out, and with guns drawn, they looked at him and began to speak to him, but there was a big problem, and the problem was that Pepe Rodriguez did not speak English, and the Rangers didn't speak any Spanish. So they pulled a guy, and they said, we need a translator, and the translator came, and they said, Pepe Rodriguez, we know you've stole all this money. We know you have tons of loot from our banks. If you don't return that money now, we will take you back, and you will be hung. And if you refuse right now, if you won't go with us, we will shoot you on the spot. And the translator then turned to Pepe Rodriguez and gave him everything that the U.S. Rangers, the Texas Rangers had just told him, explained all this to him. And Pepe Rodriguez looked at him and began to have a little bit of fear and looked at the translator and said, all right, if you go to this old farmer's and explain exactly where it was, there is a place. I have dug a hole and I have buried all of the money that I stole in that hole, and it is there, and they can go find it. Just let me go free, and they can have all the money back and take it back where it goes. And the translator looked at the Texas Rangers, looked them right in the eye and said, I'm going to tell you what Pepe Rodriguez has said. He has said that you are a bunch of lily-livered, no-good bums. Shoot him if you want, but he is not telling you anything. Would that be what we do? Like, you know, this opportunity, hey, I know where the gold is now, and I know where I can get away with this. You know, money is an interesting issue. It's an interesting challenge. The issue of wealth and riches And for us, we tend to come into a sermon like this, and we'll identify very quickly with the people who are kind of on the less wealthy end of things and feel like we're kind of the oppressed. And James comes at the church, this early church, quickly with very strong words to the rich. We like that. We like the rich people getting their just due, right? We like when somebody will stand up and say what needs to be said to those no-good, dirty scoundrels, the 1% who own it all. They need to hear this strong message from James. What I want to do real quick is I want to paint a picture of a vision that I believe God has for your life. And what the story of the gospel is this, that there is a good God who is the creator of heaven and earth. He loves us deeply, that we are broken and fallen, and we all the time tend to replace God with everything else except God. And our lives are disconnected from him. But the vision the Bible has for your life is a life where you find in Christ everything. And the outcome is that there is just a wealth of blessing that is beyond your comprehension, beyond your ability to know, that God is pouring himself into your life and you're experiencing blessings, and God answers prayer and fills our lives. And sometimes that does relate to promises like, my God will meet all your needs according to his riches and glory. And the blessing of a God who does help us through struggles and meets our needs and cares for us. And yes, that does have to do with the material world, the physical world, that God does bless us in that way. But the core of this is a God who blesses us in all these other ways that are so much deeper and so much richer. And there is a promise that no matter how hard life gets here, no matter how much I scrape and struggle and just try to make it from paycheck to paycheck and put food on the table and, you know, put clothes on my kids' backs, no matter how much I worry and fret and go through hardships here, this is not all there is. And the promise of the gospel from cover to cover in the Bible is that God loves you, he is for you, he is with you, he has come himself into our story and suffered. We never struggle or suffer alone. We suffer and struggle with a God who is by our side, who has entered our suffering and struggle with us, and that God wants to pour his grace and his goodness into your life so that we overflow now and have an eternity to look forward to. But as we read the Bible, I will just tell you that one of the clearest ways that the Bible is just like over and over, scriptures are over and over pointing out, Jesus himself echoes this. The prophets in the Old Testament, there are passages where Paul talks about this, and James is going to say it very strongly, that one of the quickest ways for us to cut ourselves off from the blessings that God has for us is to live our lives fixated on the idea of money and wealth. Now, the Bible's not going to tell us that owning and having things is a bad thing in and of itself, but it is going to, Jesus even warned that the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. And that there becomes a posture of our heart that very quickly looks at what I have and then sees my life through the lens of what I have in terms of my house, my car, my clothes, my neighborhood. And I either find in that contentment because of what I have, and my identity is wrapped up in what I have because I'm okay, or I find discontentment because I'm comparing myself to somebody who has more. And what happens is that all of a sudden that becomes this major roadblock to experience all that God has to bless you with. And what we do in America is we create whole theologies and whole church systems that cater to that. Like you could go to churches all over who in some way, they won't say it like this, but what they will basically say is greed is good, and you have a God that if you will just believe in him will cater to your greed. He'll give you all you want. Just believe the right things and he'll make you rich and everything will be great. He'll give you houses and cars. Or there is another version of this that really takes a posture of being negative towards the poverty and broken in the world and trusts in a religion of politics that says, you know, if we just had a certain political system, we could fix everything and it would, you know, make everybody perfect and great and they would have all they need if we just follow this certain political way of doing things. And we do kind of church with the real core of who we are around a certain view of political issues. And ultimately what we need is to be reminded that the gospel is going to push against this in our lives very clearly, okay? So what happens is that there is a call in the gospel to this. So I heard a story about a farmer who, like, everybody in town just saw him and he just seemed to be blessed. Like, every part of his life seemed to be blessed. He was full of joy. His heart was full of worship, active in his church, just involved in all kinds of things. And finally, somebody looked at him and said, listen, we just watch you, and you're the most generous person in this town. You just give to everybody. You're just free with your money. You just, like you're writing checks to people who are struggling. You're giving money to all kinds of needs. You're generous in your church. What is the deal? It seems like the more you give, the more blessed your life is. And he says, here's the way it works. He says, I've realized that because of the gospel, my job is to shovel as fast as I can everything that I have into God's bin. And I also realized that the gospel is that God, loving me, shovels everything he has into my bin. But this is what I've grown to learn, that God has a bigger shovel. And that's the truth of the gospel, that when we understand the goodness of God, and we understand that God, whatever our situation, whatever our plight, whatever our struggle, that God loves us and he is pouring his grace with a big, ginormous shovel into our lives, we cannot give God. And James is going to address this. And so here's what I want to do real quick before we look at the text. I want to give you my outline. I'm going to lay out exactly what I want to say to you or what I think the text is saying to us this morning. And kind of the big idea this morning is I want to show us that kingdom people, if we truly have found Christ as our King, if we truly have looked into the gospel and seen the beauty of Jesus and the wonder of the gospel, that the transformation in our lives means this, that kingdom people do wealth, riches, and money differently than the world. Because we live in a world that values ambition and greed. We're told over and over again that that's what ought to be driving our lives, is ambition and greed. We're told, you know, kids are told, why do you need to go to college? So you can have a huge job and make lots of money and have lots of power. And why do you need this and that? Like, we're just told over and over again through our media, through different newspapers, through just TV shows, that what we really need to value is ambition and greed. And then the gospel comes into our lives, and what happens is that God shapes our lives so that all of a sudden we see these things through a totally different lens. So here's the outline this morning I have for you. First of all, I want you to know that we should be grateful because God is a giver. These are four values the gospel will press into our lives. And first of all, we should be grateful because God is a giver. That what the gospel, over and over again, James is going to bring this out this morning, kind of addressing two groups of people, but anywhere you look in the Bible, if you were going to look at Jesus' words, if you're going to look in the Old Testament, what you would have is this call to have a thankful heart. Those of you who know VeggieTales know the Madame Blueberry song, you know, a thankful heart is a happy heart. I'm glad for what I have. That's an easy place to start, right? Because we understand I am thankful because I have a God who at the core of his being is a giver. That like the one verse that we know in the Bible is this, for God so loved the world that he gave, right? That's the heart of the gospel, that God loves and God gives and his grace is enough, and that all of a sudden I look at what I have and no matter what it is, I can be thankful because I have a God who at the core is a giving, gracious God, that God is a giver. Second thing I want you to see this morning is we should be content because Jesus is enough. What happens for us is that all of a sudden we lose sight of the beauty of Christ and we think that things will satisfy. We think that our stuff will make up for it. And we do this from two vantage points. If we tend to have a little more wealth, we settle into that as what really makes life click. Or if we feel like we are less able to care for ourselves, we begin to look at what others have and just begin to dream, if I only had that, and if I only had that, and if I only had that, life would work. And over again, the Bible is calling us to nurture contentment. Like it's just everywhere. Philippians 4, Paul says, I've learned the key. I can do all things through Christ. We like that verse on a coffee mug, right? Do all things through Christ who strengthens me. What he's talking about there is he says, I've learned the key to being content in the moments where I have nothing or if I have everything. The key to contentment is knowing that no matter what situation, it is Christ who is my center. Contentment. Nurturing this. Like as followers of Jesus, we go, you know, Christ, you are enough. You are my all in all. Your blessings now and your promise of heaven is all that I need. Everything on top of that is just being blessed. Our society doesn't know on any level how to nurture contentment, but kingdom people will find that Jesus is enough and will begin to nurture that in their life. Third thing I want you to say this morning is we should care about justice because God is a judge. Issues of justice in our society ought to matter to us. And I'm just telling you lovingly from my experience in West County churches, my experience over the years is that the churches I've been in have not been real in tune to the cries of justice in the culture. And it is something, when we hear issues of injustice, our first response ought to be to stop and listen and engage the stories of people who are making those cries, rather than build a whole system of arguments to say that their cries of injustice are unfounded. And James is going to be like crazy clear this morning about this. So the third thing is we should care about justice because God is a judge. And then number four, we should be generous because God has blessed. We should be generous because God has blessed. And ultimately, what happens is that the scriptures, as kingdom people who have Jesus, a good, benevolent king who loves us, who is a generous, giving God, as he pours himself into our lives, what it's going to do is it's going to shape our lives so that we become more and more and more generous. And we understand that when God does bless us, his purpose for blessing us financially is so that we can increase our standard of giving and not so much so that we can increase our standard of living. That God's desire for us is to just become more and more generous because generous people reflect the heart of the God who has saved them. And so what happens is in a world where greed and ambition are valued, where contentment is just seen as something to be shunned and pushed away from, that people who experience the grace of God will have God pour his grace into our lives as we begin to live as kingdom people, and we grow in our thankfulness, we grow in our contentment, we care about justice, and all of a sudden we are super generous, and all of a sudden the outside world looks at people who are like that and goes, something radical different here. This is not the values the world has when it relates to their stuff. And so what we're going to do is we're going to see this in James this morning. James is already in this letter. If you're new this morning, you're hanging out for the first time, James is a letter written by Jesus' little brother to the early church. This letter was written probably within 15 years of Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection. James had rejected Jesus as the Messiah. You know, he grew up with Jesus in his home, and, you know, it'd be hard to have Jesus as an older brother. You know, you constantly have your mom and dad going, I wish you could be like your older brother. I mean, some of us grew up with the, like, perfect brother, perfect sister syndrome. Wish you'd be more like your brother. Well, in James' case, he's like, listen, he's the Son of God. What do you want from me? Right? But James, when Jesus rose again, when he saw his brother that was crucified on Friday, alive on Sunday, it changed everything. And James is now the pastor of this, like one of the key leaders, pastors of this very first church in this key city of Jerusalem. And he is now writing a letter to other churches, other Christians that are kind of in the region, challenging them to have an authentic faith. And if you've been with us, he's like looked at all kinds of areas, and sometimes he's just like, James doesn't hold back word. He's just kind of like, here it is, direct. And this morning, in this issue of our wealth, the idea of wealth stuff, he's going to address two people. He's going to address the rich, and he's going to address those who are the working type people who are struggling, who are more living in poverty. And we're going to look at this, and we're going to kind of see his tone, what he says, But what we're going to find is that these four ideas are just woven in the message to both groups. All right, so grab a Bible, turn to James. If you don't have a Bible, we have Bibles for you at the end of your row. James chapter 5, page 871 in the Bibles there at the end of your row. Pass those down. If you have an app, you can find James in your app, chapter 5. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to read in commentary the text, kind of laying out how he does this, okay? How he interacts with these two groups of people, and you will see a boldness with one group, a compassion with the other, but a clear message to both that fits what's been said here. And then we're going to get to the end and say, okay, so what about us? Where does this fit with you and me? All right? James chapter 5, verse 1. Come now, you rich. Now, here's the first thing is this is not the first time James has addressed these people. In James chapter 1, he's already addressed the wealthy, the rich, and he warns them that they should, in their riches, should mourn and wail. He's going to echo that here because they need to know that their riches will not bring them what they are hoping it will bring them. And he's addressed to those who are living in poverty to rejoice in the riches that they have in Christ. In chapter 2, we find out that the rich are coming to their church. And what's happening is that the leaders of the church are showing favoritism by setting up, like, in the front rows, great places for the rich to sit. And in the back, they don't even have chairs. They're making poor people come in and sit, like, in the back corner where they will have to sit on the floor and just kind of be ignored. But they're making a big deal about the rich. So the rich are coming. And when James speaks here to the rich, there's a lot of debate. Are these rich people Christians or are they not? I think specifically he's warning them that if they're not careful, they're not. But on some level, they are coming to church. And so James speaks to them. He says, come now, you rich. Look at what he says. Weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon you. That's not normally the message. Like, all of a sudden, one Sunday, we show up at Genesis, and all of a sudden, there's like 40 people from Fortune 500 companies sitting right here in the front rows. It would probably not be wise if we want to keep them around for me to stand up and go, hey, all you rich people, y'all need to start crying and wailing and fussing because your riches ain't worth nothing and you're just all messed up, your lives are terrible, and we just want to let you know how bad you are, right? That's probably not the way to win them as friends. But that's what James does. He says, you need to howl and weep. The word howl there is literally the idea of crying out to God for mercy. You need to do this because, verse 2, your riches have rotted and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver have corroded and their corrosion will be evidence against you and will eat your flesh like fire. And you have laid up treasure in the last days. Listen to what he says. He says, what's going to happen for you is that your riches are going to turn into a horror movie. Like your riches are going to become Freddy Krueger or Jason, right? That they are going to corrode, they're going to turn bad, and then he says they're going to take a witness stand. So what's going to happen? This is what he's saying to the rich. He's saying you're going to be in a court, and all of a sudden your rotten gold and your moth-eaten clothes that you've had in your riches are going to come take the witness stand, and they are now going to testify against you. They're going to be a witness against you in this court, and then they're going to come off the witness stand and turn into this like a whole Ghostbusters evil thing and attack you and just eat you up, and that's what's going to happen with your riches. That's not what you hear in the message of the gold digger digger, right? That's not the message you're going to hear from our culture, that if you put your hope in riches, you will have all that you need, and so pursue greed. James says, listen, when you put your hope in that, this is where it goes. He is speaking here very much like the Old Testament prophets who spoke to the people of their days with very direct messages. And here's what often happens. People who have means in a culture are so tied to so many systems. They have political power. They have economic power in a culture. They have a way to get certain things done. They're tied to so many systems that when you have wealthy people who value nothing but their wealth, what it ends up doing in the culture is devastating, right? And there's a ton of people. And all through history, it doesn't matter what kind of economic system we have. It doesn't matter if it's a king over his people, if it's landowners and serfs, if it's capitalism or communism, it doesn't matter what system we have. when greed is exalted and wealthy people have access to all the good things, but they do it by suppressing broken people. It's devastating on the culture. And James is saying, put your hope there. It's not going to end well. And he gets very specific. Look at verse 4. Behold, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, are crying out against you, and the cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts. Here's what's happening in this culture. The wealthy were the landowners, the ones who had access to property that was their own. And you had all these workers who would work fields. And the mowing here is not like they're out there with their lawnmower. They are harvesting the fields and bringing in the harvest for the landowner. And what's supposed to happen is at the end of each day, the landowner is then supposed to pay the worker. But when they come in, the landowner just blows them off. Once he has all his grain in his barn, he just blows them off. And he knows there's nothing they can do. There are no legal rights. There's no remedy. There's no way for the poor to solve this problem. And he just kind of laughs at them in the bank. And what's happening in the culture, and I think this is what James is saying, is that there are some people who are doing that, but the rest are ignoring it. And so there's a systematic injustice going on at this time that is related to the worker as he's relating to the landowner, as the landowner is putting people in a position where they are wronging them. And other landowners might be writing checks and paying their end, but they are just looking the other way when they know this is going on. Now there's a systematic problem that is leading to the oppression of the workers and the exaltation of the rich, and the rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer, and in all of this, there is a brokenness. And he tells them this is what's going on, and he says, listen, they don't have anybody to go to except God. And they are praying. And they are praying, and he uses an Old Testament term. It's a term, the Lord of hosts. That's a kind of a weird host. What's that mean? The word host is the Lord of armies. I mean, that's what it means. They're praying to God, who has a big, old, ginormous army, and he's hearing their prayers, and one day the army's coming, and they're coming for you. That's what he's saying in the text. Like, really, like, not gentle, not sweet, stern. I think the reason this happens in the Bible is because we have this tendency to look at the wealth as role models and what I want to be someday. And the wealthy set themselves in a place where they feel invincible. And the only type of message that will get through to a culture that has valued wealth is a message that, when it's speaking to the wealthy, is stern, direct, and clear about the coming judgment of God, and that your money will not save you from that. And so that's what James does. He's just like, hey, this is what you're doing. Look at verse 5. He says, you have lived on the earth in luxury and in self-indulgence, and you have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. You've condemned and murdered the righteous person. He does not resist you. And so what's happening, once again, he's clear about the situation today, but he uses language. He says, you've lived in luxury and self-indulgence, and you have fattened yourself, listen to this language, fattened yourself for the day of slaughter. Here's the picture that's going on. You have this cow that's out in the field right now, and the farmer brings the cow into a barn, right? And the farmer is just shoveling corn as fast as he can shovel, and the cow is just like, I'm not like all those other cows that are like out in the pasture. Those deer, they have to fend for themselves. I got a farmer who makes me rich, makes me, and I just eat, and it gets fatter and fatter and fatter, and the cow doesn't realize that the whole reason that the farmer is shoveling grain is because later he's eating steak, right? And here's the image that James is saying. He's saying people who hoard wealth have bought into a lie from someone, Satan specifically here, who says your wealth will make you famous, your wealth will give you your identity, your wealth will make your life worth living, and we just eat the corn. We just eat the corn, and what we don't realize is Satan is literally fattening us up for the day of redemption or the day of judgment. And eventually, there's a bad day coming, and we won't realize that the whole reason, like, if you were to go to a cow and go, you keep eating that corn, the farmer's going to eat you, they'd be like, I'm out. Grass is great, right? But it's not until the slaughterhouse that the cow has any sense of what the whole thing was going on. That's the image here. And he says, what's going on is that the worker, the people who are in poverty in your culture, they're crying out to God. They have no remedy here. And you're either, and he uses the language of murder, which means apparently even in the culture, the injustice has led to violence and some level of death in the culture as a result of this. And then they come to church on Sunday morning. A crazy clarity here, right? Then we get to the second group. And all through this, understand, he's told them that you're ungrateful. I mean, clarity, he points out the fact they're ungrateful. They are never content. They are the ones who are involved in injustice and care very little about the issue of justice. And they are not generous at all. They just hoard to themselves and live in luxury and self-indulgence. But then he addresses people who struggle, people who are working class, people who tend to be those who are in poverty, and his tone changes. He says this, "Be patient, therefore, brothers, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, being patient about it until it receives the earthly and late rains. You also be patient, establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Do not grumble against one another, brothers, so that you may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. As an example of suffering and patience, brothers, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Behold, we consider those blessed who remain steadfast. You've heard of the steadfastness of Job and have seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful." So this is what he says. He says to the poor, to the struggling, to the people who are just trying to figure out day to day how to make this work and fit, when you are oppressed, what do you do? He says, be patient. Wait for the day of the Lord, the coming of the Lord, where as a righteous judge, he will come to judge the living and the dead, which means you will be vindicated if you have honored Christ in your life, and God will judge those who've been part of the oppression. He gives the example of the farmer. He says, listen, no matter how much you want to, the crops in the field grow at their own time. And so also, these things in our life, these later, early and later rains come when they come. You just need to keep trusting and hoping in God. Establish your hearts, verse 8. In other words, just keep driving the roots of the gospel deep into your soul so that you keep being reminded that your hope is not in more stuff. Your hope is in Christ. For the coming of the Lord is at hand, meaning that he will come at any moment. Now, it's kind of weird. 2,000 years ago, he wrote the coming of the Lord is at hand. It hadn't happened yet, or has it? What happens when you read the Bible is you understand the coming of the Lord has tiers. We've been studying Revelation with a group of men on Tuesday mornings at Bread Co. We're almost done, but if you haven't been coming, you want to come, join us at 6:30, jump in, all right? We'd love to see some of you dudes. Just join us 6:30 on Tuesday mornings at Bread Co. But we've been studying Revelation. One of the things we've realized in the study is that there is this final coming of the Lord, the second coming. But then in a very real way, Christ has kept coming in judgment all throughout history. That there was a moment where Hitler saw the coming of the Lord, right? And where evil regimes and wicked empires saw the justice of God poured out on them, as on one level, the coming of the Lord was the coming in judgment. And so whoever the oppressors are, he's reminding, listen, God will be good to you, and he will pour out justice on those who deserve it. And you may not see it in your lifetime in the final way, but you will see it in your lifetime. The coming of the Lord is at hand. Do not grumble against one another, brothers, so that you may not be judged. And so he says, listen, be very careful. When we feel oppressed, if we allow ourselves to, as oppressed people, begin to see finances and resources as the solution, we'll begin to see even our brothers and sisters is either blessing, you know, you can either give to me or you're a barrier to this, and I begin to grumble against you because you aren't meeting the needs that I feel like I have that you ought to be meeting. Well, but I'm not meeting your needs, and it's very easy when we struggle to turn to that. And that's just a sign that we are placing our faith in something other than Christ to be our source. So don't grumble. Be careful about this. Don't grumble against one another. And then he says, here's some examples of the way to do this. He throws out example one is the example of the prophets. And the example here is just real simple. What he says with the prophets is that the prophets lived hard lives, and because God sent them with this message to stand up against the king, against the rich, and against those who were doing injustice, it meant, first of all, that they were going to live in poverty. Second, they were going to be oppressed and beaten and probably, for many of them, eventually killed. And what they did is they kept honoring God in their life and proclaiming the message that God gave them to the culture, no matter what it cost them. And they did this patiently, knowing that their God would redeem them. And then he gives a second example, and I love this example. It's the example, he says, look at Job. Now, Job's this crazy Old Testament book. It's a long book. It's a really hard-to-read book. And if you're not familiar with Job, here's the basic message. Job went to bed one night, rich, lots of kids, great marriage, all was right, his health was good. He woke up the next morning and in a matter of hours lost everything. A huge disaster killed his children. He lost his family. He lost all his wealth just like that. He lost everything. And next thing you know, he ended up with scabs and boils, a horrible disease all over his body, and utter misery. And as we read the story, we realize that this all happened at the permission of God. And so Job's wife comes to him and looks at him and says, dude, just curse God and die. Just look at God and go, you know, blank you, and let him kill you and be done with it. And Job's response is beautiful. He says, listen, shall we take good from the Lord and then reject the hardness that comes from the Lord? Listen, I'm not going to do that. Whether I get good or evil, hardship or blessing, listen, here's the bottom line. I will bless the Lord. Blessed be the name of the Lord, because he is the one who gives and takes away. And no matter what comes from his hand, I will find in my God a good God who I will bless. You think, okay, he said that. What's going to happen in the next chapter is it's all going to go good. We have almost 50 chapters, a really bad wife and some horrible religious friends, and a long season of life of nothing but hardship and suffering. And we as the reader can see the purpose of God from the very first verse in the book, but Job as the one in the story can't see it. And what we get to the end is a God who is compassionate and mercy and gracious with Job. We can see that purpose as the reader. For Job to experience that, he had to walk through this season of his life. Now, there's a tenderness there, but a call to contentment, to thanksgiving, to endurance. I mean, the things that we just talked about, as he talks to the poor, talks to the rich, it's like, hey, hey, hey. Talks to the poor, it's like, hey, love you. Be patient. Hang in there. Trust in Jesus. Don't walk away. Just keep moving through this. What happens for us is that we move through our lives and our identity is often wrapped up in what we have. And we begin to see ourselves in one of these two groups. And my question for you real quick is, which group are you identifying with right now? Which group are you identifying with? More than likely, most of us immediately slip in our minds to identifying with the people in verses 7 through 10 or 11. We feel like we're probably among the ones, we experience some kind of oppression, we experience some kind of hardship. There is the rich of the world, this top 1%, so on and so forth, that have everything, and we're just the working, and we can't make ends meet, and we must be in that group of people. But what I want you to understand here for us this morning is that if we will be honest, in some relationships, we are both of these. If we're honest, in some relationships, we are the ones who are struggling to make ends meet, and there are people who are doing injustice to us, right? Like for me, it's really easy right now to point out Stan Kroenke as the big evil of the world, right? That's the low-hanging fruit this morning. For those of you who don't understand who that is, it means you don't care about St. Louis football at all. That's the owner of the Rams who got all his money because Sam Walton was like, he married into Walmart money, and he took all that Walmart money, and man, he just turned it into this and that. So we got the evil of Walmart plus the evil Stan Kroenke, and he wants to move our team, and it's also he, as a rich guy, can just mess us over here in St. Louis, and he's going to get richer while he leaves us behind. He's the evil, right? And it's easy for me to look at this and go, there's the example. Somebody needs to go take verses 1 to 6 and plaster it on his like rear view mirror of his car so he can see it. And somebody needs to read it like through a bullhorn so he can hear it. Because we feel, and we have people like that in our lives. And more than likely, we in our minds have been identifying the type of people that represent verses 1-6. And the reason we identify those is because they are real to us. But we need to be very careful that we run to the second group of verses and don't realize that we often are deeply entrenched in this. So let me just help you with some clarity about you versus the world. If you own a car and have a house, you are in the top 5%. If you live at the poverty line in the United States, which is around $10,000 income annually. Now, that's our poverty line, and it's related to our systems, I mean, where it puts you in terms of finances, but you need to realize that if you earn a little over $10,000 a year, putting you at the poverty line, you're in the top 14% of the world economically. And so what happens is it's easy for us to identify the people who are rich in our eyes and not see ourselves as this. And then it's very easy for us to write off the things that James warns us about in verses 1-6 because we can say it's those people and we don't see it in ourselves. The fact that we will benefit from injustices, we will participate in things, even sometimes just passively, that our story of wherever we are in our economics is often wrapped up in a lot of things that took place, and it's very easy for us to turn a blind eye and say, well, that all happened in the past. I didn't have anything to do with that, but there is brokenness in the world around us, and we could create very easy systems that identifies myself with the second set of verses and find great hope there, and we should, but we don't understand that there is, in a very real way, I am somebody who has been at least involved in certain injustices. I was watching yesterday a very interesting show on how states got their boundaries. And when they hit the story of the Louisiana Purchase, they reshaped the story. Do you know why we got everything west of the Mississippi through the Rocky Mountains for a bargain price of like $15 million? The story they tried to say is because of the uprising here had been done, but they didn't get it right. The reason Napoleon sold us that land at the bargain price of $15 million, by the way, it includes where we're sitting this morning, was to fund an attempt to reacquire Haiti after there was a military uprising among the slaves, and the only story in world's history where African slaves had an uprising and threw off their oppressors and fought and won their own freedom. And so what Napoleon did is Napoleon turned around and he sold the Louisiana Purchase so that he could fund an attempt to go in there and reacquire. It didn't work, and when it didn't work, he then gave Haiti its freedom on the back of a loan that they are still paying off. And what we do is we celebrate. We have a museum here in Celebrate in St. Louis that's being redone that celebrates the westward expansion of the Louisiana Purchase. And it's awesome. I mean, I'm not saying that's all bad, but very few of us have the reality that there was a deep injustice that still affects people to this day that bought America your backyard. And here's my point. Just lovingly, my point to you is that when the gospel changes us, it changes our values so that we see things a little bit differently and so that we understand that I am often the oppressed and I need justice for me. but I am also involved in performing and doing injustice. And so if God as judge comes, what I want is a God who will come and be a judge who deals with the injustice that is done to me. I don't on any level want a God who looks at what how I've participated both actively and passively in the brokenness of the world. I don't want a God who comes and does justice to me. And what's the remedy? And the remedy is the gospel, right? Because, I mean, I hope, I've said this here several times, Genesis, and I hope you hear this. I am at the same time a person who has been wronged. The world, the systems, people have wronged me. And I am hoping for justice and a God who will be the final arbiter and who will get those people, right? Who will bring justice in the earth so that I will receive the justice that I am hoping for. But I don't see myself through those same lenses, and therefore I ignore the fact that there are people who may be praying to the God of hosts about me and my people praying that the God of justice will stand against us. I don't like that. So I want justice for me. I don't just want justice that is to me. And the only remedy is when I see both sides of this and I run to the gospel. And here's the beauty of the gospel. That the story of the gospel is that God, who is the owner of everything, became poor for us. And he entered into the story. And the crazy thing is, we don't see Jesus entering into the story in a palace. We see Jesus entering in the store. I mean, you ever see one of those magnets on somebody's refrigerator that says, hey, were you born in a barn? Jesus answers, yeah, I actually was. Right? God, who is rich, became poor and entered our story, and then he absorbed the justice that was due us. But he also absorbed the justice that was due the person that I think deserves justice too. And the gospel is the only remedy. And so either I'm going to keep crying for justice against somebody else but don't want it against me, or I'm going to run to the cross. And when I run to the cross and I understand God, who is rich, became poor, he engaged the justice that was due, he paid the penalty for my sin, and therefore the cross gives me grace where I deserve justice, right? Get it? Where the cross gives grace where I deserve justice. As the cross filters into my life, I become a person who says, where grace is deserved or justice is deserved, I'm going to cry out to God and hope for grace. And I become an agent not of the world systems. I become an agent who either whose life is shaped by the values of the gospel, which bring us back to our 4 points, right? Look at it again. Throw it up there, man. We should be grateful. Because God is a giver. Like, is our heart being shaped by being grateful? If I'm wealthy in here today, which I've already said that on one level is all of us, am I more concerned about how I get more, or have I come to the point where I say, whatever it is I have, I'm not going to compare myself to the Joneses. I'm not going to try to reach the next level. I'm going to be so thankful for all the blessings of my life and run to Christ as my source. Am I nurturing contentment as I go, you know what? Christ is enough. And like Paul, whether I am broke and have nothing or whether I am blessed financially and have everything, the key to contentment is that I can do all things through Christ, that he is my all in all. Is Jesus enough? Or have we just really embraced that Jesus is good, but I need to be at a place and in a system that will make sure that I get all this other stuff because everybody else has it? Contentment. We should care about justice because God is a judge. And I just want to encourage us this morning that I think what the gospel should do in us is it should give us ears that hear really quickly. If there are cries of justice, whether it's from a community that is a community of ethnicity or poverty or, whatever the community is, if there are cries of injustice, I understand that the solutions are uber complex. I'm not saying that the church always has to come up with all the solutions, but we should be quick to listen, slow to speak, full of compassion. We should learn people's stories. I have learned in my life that it is hard to shut off the cry of injustice. I mean, it's very easy to shut off the cry of injustice if I have no relationship. But if I will sit down and hear somebody's stories, I begin to mourn with those who mourn and rejoice with those who rejoice. And all of a sudden, it matters. It matters. And so justice becomes something that matters because our God is a God who is a just judge, but he's also a God who gave us grace. And we should be generous because God is blessed, which means that there ought to be ever and growing a connection to making a difference in the world through the wealth that God has blessed us with. And so what he says, the final verse, verse 12, he says this. Look at this. He says, so, above all, my brothers, do not swear either by heaven or by earth or by any oath, but let your yes be yes and your no be no, so that you may not fall under condemnation. He's quoting his big brother here. Matthew chapter 5. He's quoting his big brother, Jesus. And what he's talking about here is he's saying, so what it does, what the gospel will build into our lives is an amazing integrity. So that I don't, like, I'll be the type of person who, when I walk into the courtroom, when people know me in the courtroom, everybody else are putting a Bible and saying, do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth? They're like, I don't need to give you the Bible. We know that when you speak, it's honesty. That when somebody comes into your place of business, they just know you have integrity. I don't have to worry about whether you're going to cheat me, defraud me. When somebody is broken, they know that if you say, hey, I'm going to help you out with this, that you're like, we just become the type of people because of the gospel that are full of integrity because Jesus really matters to us. And that's where it takes us. So is that happening? I'll just close with this as the band comes this morning. I got, like, here I've been in this text all this week, and they just had my heart deeply confronted with the pain that people are in this world, and the hope that only the gospel can give. Show up at the church office, which is at the Eureka Self-Storage building this morning, with police cars there. My first thought is, oh my gosh, we left the building open. Somebody who was up there, like, working for Genesis left the door open. They've come in and stolen everything, right? So I started talking to a lady who kind of runs the office and said, what's going on? And she said, oh, it's nothing with you guys. She said, well, to be honest, we have a person who is now sleeping in their storage building, which is illegal. But she said he used to be a commander in our armed forces. And I found some things about him. And she just, I mean, this is a woman, she's actually an agnostic, doesn't believe in Jesus, but I could just see her heart struggling with, he can't do that. I have to protect the other people who have a storage facility. But her heart was hurting for this guy who has come to the point where his only option was to sleep in the place he was written to keep his stuff. I just think the gospel's got to keep our chin up and our eyes open and help us re-see the way our stuff relates to us. That we don't have sticky fingers, but that we become generous, content, thankful, God-fearing, justice-loving people because we have a good God who's done everything for us, who became poor for our sake that we might become rich. Jesus, we thank you this morning for your word, for what it has to say to us. And for some of us, I know this was a challenge. Really, it should have been for all of us. But I just pray that you will help us see the solution of this in the gospel, and you will give our lives a lot of hope that you are enough, and that we will become more generous and content people, and that justice will matter to us as a result. In your name we pray. Amen.